I'm Captain Kevin Smith, and this is Throttle Up, a radio show and podcast dedicated to the proposition that critical thinking, when employed, can dramatically improve performance in whatever we are doing, enable us to solve problems that others avoid, equip us to become thought leaders instead of followers, and provide us with the intellectual resources and moral courage to support and defend America and its Constitution. Our motto is clarify, reason, win. That is, clarify the actual, employ analytic reason, and achieve mission success. Our website, throttleupradio.com, that has all kinds of information. Also, our podcast is located there, as well as iTunes. And of course, we have a blog, so please visit our website. Our support staff, Evergroove Studios for audio engineering services. They are located in Evergreen, Colorado, and Reflections Printing for multimedia support, and they are located in St. George, Utah. Our book is Critical Thinking Essentials, Quick Reference Handbook. It is available from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other outlets. Our broadcast time on Red State Talk Radio, we are on the weekends, both Saturday and Sunday, on the main channel, that's at 7 p.m., and the Encore channel, that's at 6 p.m. Okay, welcome back to Throttle Up. Now, we are in the midst of a recovery from this pandemic. So, what I'd like to do for this episode is to switch gears a little bit and to take a look at some of the issues that we ought to consider, issues that would help us going forward, issues that would help us find a productive pathway forward as we return to some sustainable process with respect to our lives and with respect to our families and our communities and our country, and getting back into some kind of a productive lifestyle that will sustain us over the long term. So, you know, we hear a lot of, I guess from my perspective, I think what's happening is we are bombarded on a daily basis with things that are designed to catch our attention, to capture our attention, but are not all that significant in the giant scheme of things. They are little blips on the radar. And sometimes blips on the radar are false targets, and they are not of serious consequence. So what do we want to do here for this particular episode, this particular radio show and podcast? Okay, so what I thought we would do is we would look at, or I guess you could say for those long-term listeners, I guess you could say that we're going to revisit something that has been front and center in the past, perhaps, but I think it's useful. So this episode is a special edition of Throttle Up Radio Show and Podcast. And the title of this special edition is Innovation After COVID-19, or to put it more simply, a special edition on innovation. What is it? How do we get it? And, or what is it? Why do we need it? And how do we get it? Those three questions. All right. So let me do that again. I sort of like mumbled through that. So innovation, with respect to innovation, what is it? Why do we need it? Or why do we need such a thing in our lives? Can we get by without it? Is it all that necessary? And of course, if we want it, if we think it is important, if we think it is vital, then how do we get it? Now, that last thing is a particularly difficult, if you will, area for us. And I actually don't quite understand all of the reasons why it is so difficult to get it. If we want it, if we think it's important, we kind of work around the edges and we're not all that good at focusing in on those exact ways in which innovation emerges. In other words, can we design something that will bring forth innovation or innovation and creativity? Can we design something that will bring it forth? And so that is my idea, and that is my quest. Now, I've got to read a couple of the reason for this, of course, is once again, it is something that is front and center on the minds of many people. And what is that? Well, what is that is obviously that the big lesson learned here from this global pandemic and from this pandemic that is seriously affecting the lives of everyone on planet Earth. The big takeaway, in my view, is we have simply not been prepared. We have not prepared ourselves. And we have a very, very difficult time trying to come up with innovative solutions such that this never happens again. We sort of like default to the blame game. We love to blame it on somebody else. We love to blame it on others. We love to avoid taking responsibility, and the list goes on. Okay, so now here's what I'm trying to do here on the special edition that deals with innovation. We're going to kind of take a bit of a deep dive into this field or into this conceptual arena that we often called innovation. I like to use the terms innovation and creativity. It also, of course, and I've mentioned this before, it also includes other things that are similar to innovation and creativity. One of them is ingenuity. That is also part of it. And inspiration. And last but not least, intention. All right, so let's press on with this, with our discussion. Now, here is an article in the Wall Street Journal. Of course, that's one of my favorite places to go because it's pretty good. It's not perfect. I don't buy everything, but it's not bad as a source of information. There are other sources out there that are probably better, but I use this because it's a good source. And it's in the Saturday, Sunday edition, May 16th, 17th, 2020 of the Wall Street Journal. It's in the review section, and it's an article by Matt Ridley. The title of the article is Innovation Can't Be Forced, But It Can Be Quashed. He headlines the article by saying, to solve 21st century problems, innovators need the freedom to experiment without the burden of overregulation and the abuse of intellectual property rights by vested interests. So I'm going to read this and then I'm going to make comments along the way and interject some things that I have been involved with. I've been involved with quite a bit of things that you might call innovation initiatives. What is that? What are innovation initiatives? In my career in aerospace, my career in aviation has been, and I don't use aerospace lightly because I was involved in helping put some of the first satellites that were reconnaissance-oriented satellites. I was involved in that initiative as well. And so what is it that we need to seriously consider and spend some quality time on thinking and discussing and promoting this idea of innovation and creativity? Now, the first order of business, I would say, before I begin this article, the first order of business is that it would be good for all of us to understand that we need to establish a platform. We cannot launch this thing. We cannot get this thing up and running without a platform or without a runway. And so if we're going to get this idea airborne, we're going to have to launch it from a platform or from a runway. And what is that? The runway has to be solid, has to be robust, it has to be effective. And what is this platform that we need? Now, I would say that from my perspective, the first thing that is almost always neglected in our thinking, when we put our thinking cap on, the first thing that is almost always neglected is this whole idea that we must establish some kind of a platform, and it must be a coherent platform, that whatever we put in that platform or whatever the platform consists of, it must be self-reinforcing, and it must be coherent, and it cannot be discontinuous. It must exist on some kind of a continuum. So, and discontinuities will exist in our thinking process, and we need to understand that, and we need to find ways to overcome it. Okay, so what is the platform? The platform, and I've mentioned this many times before, the platform begins by seriously considering the art and science of critical thinking. We must achieve the ability to think critically in complex, stressful situations. Okay, let me say that again for emphasis. We must be able to achieve the capability to think critically under conditions of complexity and uncertainty. So complex things that are urgently needed, but we need to understand that whatever we're trying to do, whatever we must do, involves dealing with things that are complex and uncertain. Those are the areas which we need to develop our capability. So critical thinking under conditions of complexity and uncertainty. We need to be able to say that we are good at it because we have been specifically or professionally trained to do so. And you say, well, how do I get this into my workforce that is already overworked and overwhelmed? And how do I get this into my busy life because my life is overworked and overwhelmed as well? And the answer is that you cannot go into this process with a defeatist attitude. And many of us unfortunately do. And that's my great disappointment. And that was my great disappointment in working with others in the field of aviation. Most of the people that I work with, not all, but most of the people that I work with were overwhelmed, were just trying to get through the day, and were not predisposed to carve out some quality time by which they can or could improve their power of reason. Okay, so critical thinking, or being able to think critically under conditions of complexity and uncertainty, it forms part of the foundation by which innovation grows, all right? So you have to be able to think critically. You have to also add a couple of other ingredients to this recipe for innovation. What is the other ingredients that you need to form the recipe for innovation? One of the big things, and we have talked about this endlessly, I think, on this radio show, time and time again. One of the other things is we have to be able to get out of the weeds and employ big picture thinking. So big picture thinking and critical thinking go hand in hand. We have to be able to do that. Big picture thinking and systems thinking are synonymous, in my view. They are one in the same. You can go it both ways. In aviation, we call it big picture thinking. And it's been around for many, many years. I think it probably started during military aviation in World War II. I know that in my career in aviation, we constantly used it. What is the big picture? Can you maintain the big picture? What was the cause of the accident? The cause of the accident was that the pilot lost the big picture. All right, so big picture thinking is crucial, as well as critical thinking. Now, put those two together, and we then can achieve what I call higher order reasoning. Now, what is higher order reasoning? Higher order reasoning is the ability to solve the really big problems, to bring to bear, to bring enough intellectual resources to bear to solve the really big problems. Higher order reasoning employs out-of-the-box thinking. All right, so higher order reasoning embraces those things that are non-traditional. Higher order means that it exists in a conceptual space that transcends any one particular discipline. We need to, and this is critical. Everybody tends to be invested in their own discipline. And that's okay, but that's not all there is. And that should not be all there is. We need to be able to rise above our own traditional way of thinking, our own discipline, which is steeped probably in tradition. We need to be able to rise above that and think and employ higher order reasoning, which higher order reasoning basically is that we have broken down the silos, or we have risen above the technological and intellectual silos that exist. We have risen above them. And in doing so, we have opened the door for continuous stream of innovative ideas to enter. Okay, back to Matt Ridley. The COVID-19 pandemic reveals that far from living in an age of incessant technological change, we have been neglecting innovation in exactly the areas where we need it most. Faced with a 17th century plague, we are left to fall back mainly on the 17th century response of quarantine and closing the theaters. It is commonplace today to say that innovation is speeding up, but like much conventional wisdom, he says, it is wrong. I would, and that's Matt Ridley saying that, and I would agree with him. I know it sounds a little bit cynical, but I would agree with him. I think we have touted the idea of innovation. We have used it, but I don't think we understand what it takes to be innovative, either personally or organizationally. I just don't think we understand it. And so he basically is taking us to task. Some innovation is speeding up, certainly, but some is slowing down. Take speed itself. He says, in my lifetime of more than 60 years, I've seen little or no improvement in the average speed of travel. Congestion on the roads and the airports has, in many cases, increased the scheduled time between two points. A modern airliner with its high bypass engines and less swept wings is designed to save fuel by going more slowly than a Boeing 707 did in the 1960s. The record for the fastest manned airplane was set by the X-15 rocket plane in 1967 and remains unbroken. Boeing 747s are still flying half a century after they were launched. Concorde, by the way, the only supersonic passenger plane is history. Also, I would add there the supersonic bomber. There was two supersonic bombers that were built by this country. One of them actually flew for 10 years. It was a B-58. B-58 flew actively in the Air Force for 10 years. Retired early, I think, was a huge mistake, frankly. I have talked a number of B-52 pilots. A B-58. This is B-58. If I misstated that, I apologize. It's the B-58 Hustler was a operational supersonic bomber built by Convair, flown by the U.S. Air Force, and I have met a number of B-58 pilots. And the airplane was quite remarkable. It actually could exceed Mach 2. It's a Mach 2 bomber, which was really quite extraordinary. Why it was retired, I have no idea. It should still be flying. And the other one was the XB-70. And the XB-70 was an experimental, as you can imagine, the X meaning experimental. The XB-70 was a rather large supersonic bomber. It was really quite extraordinary because this airplane could exceed Mach 3. Now, can you imagine a bomber that could fly greater than 3 times the speed of sound? That's what Mach 3 means. A number of them were built experimentally, but then the whole program was canceled and it was a tragic. I think we should restart it, frankly. You know, why? Because that's an innovation testbed. I mean, what we forget is we get involved in the moment kinds of things, and we forget the big picture. We don't look at it in terms of this is a great achievement that humans have been able to make, and let's continue with this. What is the great achievement? The great achievement is a supersonic bomber that could actually go faster than Mach 3. That is an incredible achievement, and we should be celebrating that on a regular basis. Continuing with this article by Matt Ridley, moreover, recent decades have seen innovation stalled or rejected in a number of technologies. Nuclear power has been unable to roll out plans for a new reactor design. Genetic modifications of crops was effectively rejected by Europe. The flow of new pharmaceutical drugs has slowed to a trickle. Ride-sharing apps have been banned in many cities, as the investor Peter Thiel has pointed out. innovation is now largely a digital phenomena because bits are lightly regulated and atoms heavily regulated. On all sides, we hear arguments that innovation threatens jobs, the environment, privacy, and democracy. Of immediate relevance to the current emergency, the development of vaccines has languished in the 21st century as an orphan technology, insufficiently encouraged by governments and ignored by the private sector. New vaccines are rarely profitable, but the time a company develops one for a new epidemic, the worst may be over. Last year, Wayne Koff, president of the Human Vaccines Project, warned that the world was poorly prepared for a pandemic because vaccine development is an expensive, slow, and laborious process, costing billions of dollars, taking decades with less than a 10% rate of success. It is not just vaccines. Throughout the economy, with the exception of the digital industry, the West is experiencing an innovation famine. The Austrian economist Joseph Schumpeter's perennial gale of creative destruction has been replaced by the gentle breeze of rent-seeking. Two recent books argue that big companies in cozy cahoots with big government increasingly shy away from change, sheltered against competition by regulation and intellectual property rights. In The Captured Economy, Brink Lindsay and Stephen M. Thiels makes the case that to the extent that incomes have been stagnating and opportunities for social mobility drying up, the cause is not too much innovation, but too little. In The Innovation Illusion, a book published in 2016, Frederick Erickson and Bjorn Weigel argue that Western economies have developed a near obsession with precautions that simply cannot be married to a culture of experimentation. It goes on to say, innovation relies upon freedom to experiment and try new things, which requires sensible regulation that is permissive, encouraging, and quick to give decisions. By far, the surest way to rediscover rapid economic growth when the pandemic is over will be to study the regulatory delays and hurdles that have now been hastily swept aside to help innovators in medical devices and therapies, and to see whether such reforms could be applied to other parts of the economy too. A big obstacle to innovation, he says, is the slow pace of regulatory licensing. One 2012 study found that a medical device takes around 21 months to get through the regulatory process in the U.S. from application to market and 70 months in Germany. In the specific case of the Stratos implantable pacemaker, it took 14 months in the U.S., 40 months in France, and 70 months in Italy. There is nothing new, he says, about resistance to innovation. Now, this section here is really pretty remarkable, and it points out the problems that we have as members of a particular culture or members of this planet. He says there's nothing new about resistance to innovation. In 1662, William Petty, a pioneering economist, medical professor and land speculator, lamented that the poor inventor runs the gaunt loop of all petulant wits, with everybody trying to stop him from succeeding. At the time, King Charles II, lobbied by the brewing industry, was trying to ban a novel drink called coffee because it caused fake news. As for coffee, tea, and chocolate, the king pronounced, "I know no good they do. Only the places where they are sold are convenient for persons to meet in, sit half day, and discourse with all companies that come in of state matters, taking of news and broaching of lies." I'm sorry, talking of news and broaching of lies. Hansom cab operators in London furiously denounced the introduction of the umbrella for offering shelter to rain-soaked pedestrians. Margarine was subjected to a decades-long smear campaign from the dairy industry. Musicians' unions delay the playing of record music on the radio. The Horse Association of America for many years fought a rearguard action against the tractor, and the natural ice harvesting industry frightened people with scares about the safety of refrigerators. You may laugh, but the same happens today. Incumbent vested interests over cautious regulators, opportunistic activists, and rent-seeking patent holders combine to oppose or delay almost every innovation. Surprisingly, there is no good evidence that patents are helpful, let alone necessary, in encouraging innovation. A 2002 study by Josh Lerner, an economist at the Harvard Business School, looked at 177 cases of strengthened patent policy in 60 countries over more than a century, finding that these policies changes did not spur innovation. James Watt, Samuel Morse, Guglielmo Marconi, the Wright brothers, and many others wasted the best years of their lives in court defending their intellectual property when they might have been busy developing new devices. The expiration of patents often results in the burst of innovation, as with 3D printing, where the recent lapse of three key patents has resulted in notable improvements in quality and a drop in price. The historian Anton Howes of the Royal Society of Arts in London points out that the French government bought out Louis Duruguay's patent for photography in 1839 and made the technology freely available, unleashing a burst of creative innovations. Dr. Howes argues, as we look to fight coronavirus and any future pandemics, we should perhaps consider which patents for antivirals, vaccines, ventilators, and other hygienic equipment might be bought out in order to remove innovation bottlenecks. What is innovation and how is it best encouraged? That's a question here from the author. Policymakers tend to assume it is the result of clever people having clever thoughts in ivory towers. But science is just as often the fruit as the seeds of technology, and the invention is different from innovation. To illustrate the difference, Charles Townes, who won the Nobel Prize for Physics behind the laser in 1964, was fond of telling a story of a beaver and a rabbit looking up at the Hoover Dam. The quote, "No, I didn't build it myself," says the beaver, "but it's based on an idea of mine." Discoverers and inventors often feel they get too little credit or profit from a good idea, forgetting just how much effort was needed to turn that idea into workable, affordable innovation that actually delivered benefits to people. Thomas Edison understood better than anybody that trial and error is the key to turning an innovation into a useful, turning an invention into a useful innovation. In developing the nickel iron battery, his employees undertook 50,000 experiments. Developing a new technology, he famously said, is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. Jeff Bezos, he's from Amazon, makes the same point. Being wrong might hurt you a bit, but being slow will kill you. If you can increase the number of experiments you try from 100 to 1,000, you dramatically increase the number of innovations you produce. It turns out that continuous tinkering to develop and refine a better product is much more important than protecting what you've already created. Far from sudden eureka moments, innovation is nearly always a gradual process that proceeds by incremental steps. It is a team sport. There is no individual who can be credited with inventing the computer or the internet. The introduction of the short-strawed wheat that revolutionized Asian agriculture in the 1960s resulted in the defeat of famine, which resulted in the defeat of famine, was driven by Mansoor Bajwa in Pakistan and M.S. Swaminathan in India. But they got the idea from others. And the others is a long list. Once started, innovation is so inevitable, it looks inexorable. 21 different people had the idea of the light bulb independently. Many people besides Google founders came up with a search engine in the 1960s. Given this unpredictability, politicians should rethink the incentives for innovation. One option is to expand the use of prizes to replace reliance on grants, subsidies, and patents. Britain's famous Longitude Prize, offered in 1714 for accurately measuring longitude at sea, elicited a solution from an unexpected direction. Accurate and robust clocks made by a humble clockmaker, John Harrison. The Nobel Prize-winning economist Michael Kremer came up with a concept called the advanced market commitment that would fine-tune prizes as incentives to innovate. Okay, now this article continues on, but basically we've got the major key points that I would like to have you consider. Now I've got a couple of audio clips I want to play here as well that will add to the value of the discussion.
The term systems innovation has become popular in the past decades, but the term is often left as somewhat vague. So let's start by presenting a working definition. Systems innovation can be understood as a combination of systems thinking and the process of innovation so as to enable transformative change within a complex system. So there are three primary aspects here: systems thinking, innovation, and complex systems. Systems thinking is a way of looking at the world. It is what we call a holistic paradigm, meaning that it enables us to look at, analyze, and talk about whole systems rather than simply looking at their parts. According to the Oxford Dictionary, innovation is to make changes in something established, especially by introducing new methods, ideas, or products. A complex system is typically a large-scale system composed of many interdependent parts that are relatively autonomous. All of the large-scale systems we are interested in our economy are complex adaptive systems, food systems, energy systems, political systems, health systems, financial systems, etc. So, systems innovation is about using systems thinking to enable transformative change within these complex organizations. In this section, we will elaborate on each aspect of this so as to get a high-level overview for what we mean by this term systems innovation. Firstly, what is innovation? Innovation is about the creation of something that is both new and of value. However, it is also about its adoption and implementation so as to change some established way of doing things. The key aspects of innovation are that of creativity and change. However, innovation is different from pure creativity in that it is looking at both ends of the equation, both the creation of something new and useful, but also its adoption and usage within society so as to enable real change in the world around us. According to Stephen Shapiro, innovation is simply staying relevant. This is an important aspect of innovation, whereas pure creativity is often about things that exist in the abstract. They're somewhat timeless and come from within, so to speak, like a painting or a piece of classical music. However, innovation is about responding to the environment. It is seeing how the world is changing and building something that will be relevant for that world of tomorrow. It is really what enables us to adapt to the changing environment. It is the introduction of a new solution that adds value because it fits with the overall context within which it is introduced. That is why adoption is important. If it is not adopted, that is because it does not fit with the current context and deliver value. Thus, it may be creative, but it is not really innovation because it has not actually changed anything. Typically, when we talk about innovation, we think of things, some kind of a technology, like a mobile phone, an electric bike, an app, or some other new product. We have got really good at creating, designing, and redesigning things. After many centuries of perfecting our industrial model, we have created a lot of things. Indeed, we might say we have created too many things. This type of innovation is focused on parts. Building a better car, which is just one part in the transport system. Making a better solar panel, which is just one part in an energy system. Creating a better medical device, which is one part in the health system. Whereas much of our traditional thinking is focused on parts and closed forms of incremental innovation, many of the challenges we face today require a different form of change. A different form of innovation, a form of innovation that changes systems, not just parts. The world is changing in profound ways as we move from the industrial age into an age of information, globalization, and sustainability. As our industrial age systems of organization come to the end of their life cycle, we find ourselves increasingly challenged with building whole new networked systems. The real design challenges are shifting from building things to building systems. Not another house, but designing a whole smart city. Not another power plant, but a whole smart grid. Not another car, but an integrated transport service. As the social innovator Indy Johar puts it, whilst it's cute and nice and relevant to be talking about the lovely nice things, underneath those nice things are a bunch of institutions and institutional behaviors that structure how we make our world. And to innovate, we're going to have to innovate those. What is missing today are organizations and systems that work. We have no shortage of thousands of different drugs, but we don't seem to be able to build health systems that really work the way they should. We're very good at building cars with the latest technology and fuel efficiency, but we don't seem to be able to build a transport system that works for all, including the environment. As billions of more people join the global economy from emerging markets, we find ourselves in a world of more and more people who want more and more things, and that equation is no longer adding up. What we really need is to organize those things better. We need to build systems. And this takes systems-level innovation, which is something we are not used to. We all have an idea for what innovation is, but what is innovation when you are dealing with a complex system? What does innovation look like when applied to redesigning how a whole political system works, or the public administration for millions of people and thousands of departments and sub-departments? This is not just a change in scale, it is also a change in quality. It requires a different kind of thinking and innovation. It is not something we are accustomed to. However, it is a form of innovation that we have to learn to do if we as enterprises, as governments, as open societies are going to survive in a complex, integrated global economy. Systems thinking looks at the world in terms of connections, patterns of organization, and how the system behavior emerges out of those patterns. Systems innovation is different because it is innovation not in things, but in connections and organization. It is aimed at changing the basic structure of an organization. We are not trying to change the parts. Everything that we do in systems innovation will be about changing connections so as to realize a different form of emergent behavior and functionality within the system. This is about whole systems. We are very used to thinking of innovation as only applying to things, a self-driving car, an app, a new drone, etc. But imagine building new economies. We can actually do that today. Imagine building an economy based upon a full cost accounting system, one that does not just account for financial capital, but one that accounts for social capital and natural capital as well. That would incentivize radically different behavior. This is innovation in the institutional systems that structure human activity, and we can now do this thanks to technological developments. This kind of innovation doesn't grow your economy by an extra 1 or 2%. It actually rewrites the rules of what an economy is. These are the kind of quantum leaps that are needed today if we want to keep pace and remain relevant, given the massive upheavals taking place in our world today. We are in a period of transition comparable only to that of the agrarian revolution or the move into the modern era. Staying relevant within such a transformation will require innovation on a scale and depth to match that. As Jack Welch, the former CEO of General Electricity, put it succinctly, if the rate of change outside exceeds the rate of change inside, the end is in sight. Whereas management is generally about doing what we did in the past, the point of innovation is change, to not do what you are doing again. In a paper entitled Systems Change, What It Is and How to Do It, the authors write, "Systems change is an intentional process designed to alter the status quo by shifting the function or structure of the identified system with purposeful interventions. It is a journey which can require a radical change in people's attitudes as well as in the ways that people work." Systems innovators aim to transform the system in which they operate so as to no longer have a job, as there is no longer a problem to fix. As Ashoka's founder, Bill Drayton, once said, social entrepreneurs are not content to give a fish or teach how to fish. They will not rest until they have revolutionized the fishing industry. This helps to illustrate the expansive nature of systems innovation. Systems thinking itself is holistic. Holistic approaches always refer to the whole. This makes systems thinking expansive in nature. We're always reasoning upwards and thus expanding our frame of reference. Likewise, doing systems innovation is the same. We're always looking upwards to the whole system we are a part of. We're always looking to see how our sphere of interest fits into the broader systems. For example, rather than support a person who is building a school, we search for people who are transforming the way children learn at a regional, national, or even international level. The ultimate frame of reference for all of this is the whole, complex, global economy that we now find ourselves a part of. This is relevant because as the world becomes more interconnected and thus interdependent, a narrow focus on innovation improvements within a specific area can easily get overridden by broader processes of change. At first glance, it may appear like we are able to do all sorts of things with our large organizations and all this capital we have now accumulated. But the reality is that the connectivity and complexity have happened so fast, and our institutional paradigm is so not designed for it, that we are actually able to do quite little except for perpetuating what we did in the past. The analogy of a rabbit being caught in the headlights is not too far removed from where we find ourselves today. We quite simply do not have the institutional structures to operate in this kind of complex, networked, global environment with the kind of challenges it creates. What we do have is hugely inefficient and thus ineffective given the new context. It is sobering to remember that we have not yet solved even one of the existing global issues, from climate change to cybersecurity to a refugee crisis to financial instability to soil erosion, and none of them are getting any better. But today, we have a powerful new set of technologies with which to build new organizational structures. In the past decades, we have put powerful tools for computation in the hands of many and interconnected us all with telecommunications networks. This offers the potential to innovate in virtually all spheres of human activity, to rethink virtually all of these systems as we turn the centralized organizations of today into the open networks of tomorrow. But doing that successfully requires new ways of thinking and systems innovation, the workings of which we will be exploring during this course.
Okay, so a nice discussion. Now, that's from the Systems Innovation channel, YouTube channel. And they have a lot of good stuff. I've used it from time to time on this show, giving them full credit for this series of audios and videos that help us gain a better understanding of systems thinking and big picture thinking. You notice as this commentation, as the commentator went through this process, you notice he's trying to encourage the idea of engaging in big picture thinking. And that's particularly important. We should, you know, as kind of an exercise, maybe as a morning exercise. I like the book "The Morning Mind" by Dr. Carter. I like that a lot, and I would recommend that as well. But as part of our morning mental exercises or mindfulness engagements, we ought to think specifically also about what is it about big picture thinking that I should consider, or that I need to know about, or that I can improve my ability to employ big picture thinking. What is it that I can do that would be helpful? And that's probably a good subject of some future shows. We'll try to cover that. I know we did a 10-part series on big picture thinking that I've already may have covered at least some of that, hopefully. But anyway, that concludes another Throttle Up Radio show, and we will see you all next week. Well, that went fast. So this is a close of another show, another Throttle Up. And before I go, I would like to acknowledge a few people. I'd like to thank my listening audience for being here. And I would like to thank Red State Talk Radio for providing us an opportunity for each and every weekend to put on this radio show that we call Throttle Up. And I would like to thank all of you veterans out there. Thank you for your service. And I would like to thank the families of the veterans. Thank you for supporting this noble cause. And I would like to thank all of you on active duty in the Guard and the Reserve. Thank you for serving this great country of ours. And with that, I would like to say goodbye, and we will see you all again next week.